Talking History. On News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and legacy of Copernicus, and we'll be debating how he changed forever how we understand our place in the universe. We'd love you to join our discussion. Text costs 30 cents. The number is 53106. You can also email us talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we discussed Irish literature in transition, and we explored the writers and works who are central to the Irish literature experience and how that writing has evolved over the past three centuries. And we also discussed, of course, the favourite poet of the new president-elect of the United States, President-elect Joe Biden, and his love of Seamus Heaney. Heaney, of course, got a number of mentions last week. And if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life, work, and legacy of Copernicus. Born in 1473 in Royal Prussia in Poland, Nicholas Copernicus became a brilliant mathematician and astronomer. Around 1510, he developed his heliocentric theory, an astronomical model which had the Earth and the other planets rotating around the Sun instead of having the Earth at the centre of the universe. However, given the attitudes of the time, he did not publish this theory for over two decades. Copernicus died at the age of 70 in May 1453, and in that year, his major work was finally published, On the Revolutions of the Celestial Spheres, and it changed forever the world of science and helped pave the way for the scientific revolution. And so in tonight's show, we want to debate the impact of Copernicus and the Copernican Revolution on the world. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dava Sobel is the acclaimed and award-winning author whose books include Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. A recent award praised her for using her profound scientific knowledge and literary talent to merge scientific adventures and human stories in order to give the history of science a human face. And her play, And the Sun Stood Still, about Copernicus, has been called an unforgettable portrait of scientific achievement, and which covered the tensions between science and faith. Dr. Jim Bennett is the former director of the Museum of the History of Science at Oxford University, where he was professor of the history of science, and he was also a fellow and curator at Cambridge University. This year's winner of the Sarton Medal of the History of Science Society, he has been acclaimed for his work on astronomy, navigation and practical mathematics, and he was the co-editor of the Oxford Companion to the History of Modern Science. David Moore has been called Ireland's best-known astronomer and is the chairman and founder of Astronomy Ireland, the world's most popular astronomy club, and their website is www.astronomy.ie, and he's also the editor of Astronomy Ireland's magazine. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show I'll be talking to Dr. Richard Tarnas, a distinguished cultural historian and the founding director of the graduate program in philosophy, cosmology and consciousness at the California Institute of Integral Studies, where he is a professor of psychology and philosophy. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome. And David, I might begin with you, and I might begin with, I suppose, the world in which Nicholas Copernicus was born and how much his discovery changed our understanding of the world and the universe. How revolutionary was all of this?
I think you
Copernicus is credited with the start of the scientific revolution. Before this, the church religion had dominated everything, and people were prepared to believe in things that didn't have any evidence behind them. But it was beginning to become obvious that certain things in nature could be dictated to by facts rather than divine intervention. And this whole idea that the universe was created just for mankind, that the Earth was put at the center of the universe, that everything moved around it, I mean, it did sort of fit the observations of the day, because the distances were so vast, the speeds and some of the phenomena were so beyond their everyday experience. It doesn't look like the Earth's rotating if you look out your window. So it fitted the facts. And when it got indoctrinated then into things like the Bible and the like, it became dogma. And that was beginning to go by the time Copernicus came into the world in around 1500, let's say, when he would have been well enough educated to start thinking about it himself. And it's he looked at the two theories. Aristotle had said everything was centered on man, everything moved around the Earth. Ptolemy had developed the the sort of astronomy, the mathematics or the methods, if you like, of predicting the motions of the planets. And it was complicated, but it worked fairly well. And to try and overturn that was quite a feat. And for Copernicus to do it, other people had suggested it in the past, even centuries earlier, that perhaps the sun was at the center of the universe, not the Earth. And Copernicus, though, managed to take it further than anybody else had, and admittedly on his deathbed published publicly, although his theories were widely known amongst the sort of intelligentsia of the time. And after that, then people start adding to his knowledge. Galileo sees the phases of Venus, the fact that the sun isn't perfect, it's got spots, there are mountains on the moon, Jupiter's got things going around it. So this sort of confirmed the whole theory, and the scientific method over the next century or two developed to really show the universe is just this mechanical system that doesn't really care about the humans milling around on its surface, which of course was for some people heresy.
Very good. David Sabell, I'll bring you in on this as well. And just to say, my cousin Rory, I remember, got me a copy of your wonderful book, Longitude, a few years ago. And it really made such an impact on me as an historian. And I know it has your works has influenced so many around the world. Can we talk about the paradigm shift that David has been describing there? Because it really did change so much in terms of how we understood our place in the universe.
Yes, it did. And thank you for the compliment. And also, I want to apologize. I jumped in earlier when you had called on David Moore because our first names sound so alike. And this goes on at every family gathering in my family because there are so many Davids and we're all named after the same person. So please excuse that.
Not at all, not at all.
Yes, the quintessential paradigm shift is the Earth at the center of everything, or are we just a speck in the vast cosmos? And it's pretty clear that the latter is our situation. But the idea that Copernicus took us out of the center has been interpreted in different ways. We weren't at the center because we were so important. We were at the center because that was where the heavy, unheavenly things were. The planets, the moon, the stars were all thought to be made of an entirely different material. So they had nothing to do with the Earth. And of course, the angels, the deities, God was the farthest removed from the center. So the idea that the sun, this heavenly lamp, would be put in the center was part of the objection to Copernicus's system. At first, his ideas didn't have any effect whatever on the average person. He even says in the opening of his own book that mathematics is written for mathematicians. And it is an extremely scholarly book. It's written in Latin. It has the feel of a geometry textbook. It makes no pretense to speak to a wider public. It assumes a university education. And it wasn't until Galileo began speaking about Copernicus in Italian to a wider popular audience that these ideas were spread among a non-university educated group of people.
And Deva, he does seem to have been a remarkable genius, because whatever he turned his hand in, he seemed to be quite brilliant at, whether it was as a mathematician or an astronomer or even as an economist. That he did seem to have. What was it that was so special about him?
Well, may we wonder. We have figures like Copernicus, like Galileo, like Einstein, who seem distinguished by their brilliance, who are distinguished by their brilliance. And it's always something admirable and debatable why they were the way they are. For Copernicus, one of the other things he did, which is not widely known, is that he really was an officer of the Catholic Church. And so it was a big worry to him that the things he said would be misinterpreted as going against the Bible, because the Bible says in several places that the earth is on a firm foundation, not to be moved, and that the sun goes around, and that the sun was asked to stop in its tracks at a particular moment in history. So he was very worried about the religious reception. And that is why he dedicated the book to the Pope, to Paul III.
And David, it is very interesting, that Catholic connection, because you see it variously described in some accounts, I think going back to Galileo as having been a priest, but that doesn't seem to be the case. But he does seem a kind of a canon, and was he subject to a rule of celibacy?
There may have been a rule, but he was probably not celibate.
Yes, well,
documentation that survives, letters from his bishop urging him to make his female housekeeper go away. And for whatever reason, Copernicus resisted doing that.
Very good. Jim, we'll bring you in on that, because it does seem to have been a complex relationship with the Catholic Church, and probably at the heart of his decision not to publish for so many years.
Yes, I wouldn't make too much of that, to be honest. I think David was a bit hard on the church there when he thought that, you know, when he contrasted the superstitious side among religious people and the more open-minded scientists. I mean, you know, there are lots of things we could put out of Copernicus's life that we wouldn't approve of. I mean, you know, it was very common for astronomers to be also astrologers, and there's a lot of scholars nowadays who think that one of the things that Copernicus was keen to reform and make much better was the practice of astrology. Now, we would find that now, and particularly astronomers find that anathema. But it's not in 16th century astronomy for astrology. You need good planetary positions, and you need to be able to predict and to retrodict and so on. And you need to have a really firm grasp of mathematical astronomy to pursue scholarly astrology. So I'm not saying that astrology was identified with the church. Quite the opposite. Most contrary opinion about astrology, most resistance to astrology came from the church, because after all, it depends on your confessional persuasion there. But if you have free will in your decision making about religion, then how can you be governed by the stars and so on and so on? So it was the church who were more concerned about astrology than the astronomers who generally supported it. So it's easy to take up these, you know, diametric positions, and life is more complicated than that. I'm absolutely convinced that Copernicus was, you know, a good and faithful member of his church, and he was very concerned about things like establishing the proper date of Easter, so that his astronomy could be seen to be as in service to the canonical matters. And I think the trouble which you referred to, his concern about his system being, as David said, misconstrued, that's genuine. He certainly thought that he was afraid of what he would have regarded as misjudgments, I mean, contrary, unfair judgments of his system. But he was also worried about physics. I mean, it wasn't just the church that he was concerned about. He was concerned about natural philosophers, because if you move the Earth, it's not just a matter of astronomy. How are you going to explain motion and indeed the life at all on the earth. How can we walk around and not be tossed around and thrown off and so on? And how is it that if we're hurtling through space, you know, we seem to be totally blissfully unaware of this, not just unaware from a from an astronomical point of view and observing the heavens, but unaware from our daily lives. So there are lots of issues around the Copernican account and why he might have been concerned about its release, issues to which he didn't have answers. He didn't have theological answers to the question of the biblical interpretation. He didn't have natural philosophical answers to the physical questions. So naturally, that led to a certain resonance. So we ought to be the more amazed, not that he took so long to release it, but that he was prepared when a Lutheran came to him from southern Germany, a man called Reticus, and lived in his household for several years, admittedly won over his confidence, persuaded him to take the precious manuscript of De Revolutionibus back to Lutheran Germany, and to have it published in Nuremberg. I mean, that's, to my mind, the more surprising outcome, not the fact that he prevaricated for some time to do something so radical.
Fascinating, Jim. And we know a certain amount about his public career, his studies in Poland, his training and studies in Italy, and then the return to Poland. And in terms of his personal life, how much do we know about that in terms of his relationships with other scientists and intellectuals of the time, and even in terms of how he produced how he did his research and how he developed his thinking?
Yes, I think we don't know much, and my suspicion is that that's because there isn't a lot to know. I don't think he was a natural communicator, a natural, you know, gregarious person who wanted to be mixed up in the hurly-burly of astronomical debate. He had he went to Italy, as you say, and that really affected his aesthetic sense of what how the cosmos should be. There he encountered, and that was a time of socializing for him, probably in the one time in his life when he was part of a larger community, and he certainly caught an interest in humanism in the time. That's to say, an interest in going back to the ancient Greeks and the ancients in general, and reforming our modern knowledge or our contemporary knowledge by trying to recover the principles of the past. Now, this sounds like a very conservative notion, and it is, except that it's an interesting intellectual and exciting intellectual movement in the 16th century, humanism. So he wanted to bring astronomy back to the first principles of Plato, for example. He thought that Ptolemy had neglected those. He thought that the heavens could only move in uniform circular motion, as Plato has said, because they were perfect. So the idea of the kind of rather, as he saw it, barbarous system that Ptolemy, as David said, it worked, but it wasn't very, it was a bit ugly. And Copernicus had this vision of something much more aesthetically pleasing and much more philosophically grounded. So, but then when he goes up to Frauenberg and carries out his life as a canon in the cathedral, I think he's pretty isolated. At a time when many astronomers were communicating by letter, you know, with colleagues across Europe, Copernicus is a bit of a mystery. And when Reticus goes up to see him, he's sent up there encouraged to go by a group of astronomers in Nuremberg, a man called Johann Schoener, a man called Georg Hartmann, a man called Appianus, encourage him to go and seek out this unusual, unknown figure up there and see what this story is, because there had been a circulation of a manuscript, the so-called Commentariolus in 1512, which outlined the system in a tantalizing way. It was only a manuscript that circulated among the people who were really interested in these things. So Copernicus was an isolated figure, and it was Reticus who encouraged him and brought his work into the public domain.
Fascinating. And David Moore, any good scientist gets things wrong as well as the things they get right. And I'm sure it was the same with Copernicus. So as he is working on these ideas, what elements did he go down wrong paths with? Did he get certain things wrong?
Well, as has been said, his idea that the planets still moved around the sun in circles was a big problem. We now know, of course, after Kepler, they move around in ellipses, and Newton's mathematics in Principia go on to show exactly how that all works mathematically and beautifully ties up the system, till Einstein comes along and ruins things a bit with things are moving at very high speed. But we can ignore that for most everyday purposes. So you still needed these epicycles. So if you watch a planet over weeks and months in the sky against the starry background, you actually see the planet reverse its direction and then change the direction again and continues on. So these retrograde loops that they're called, you can't explain those easily, not exactly anyway, with circular orbits. You need ellipses. I don't know if it ever occurred even to Copernicus about ellipses, but he used circles anyway, and so he still needs a lot of the kludges that Ptolemy had. He got rid of a few of them, so it was an easier system. But that was one of the big problems. And, you know, if it doesn't completely wipe out all this ugliness in the Ptolemaic system of predicting the planets, then maybe it's not right either, people could have argued. But it wasn't just that he said that the sun was at the center of the solar system, maybe not the universe. But it was also that the whole sky in the older system rotated around the Earth, and that the spheres were carrying the planets because they didn't understand gravity, that these things could just exist in space on their own. And they had no great concept of the distances. So another problem was that if the Earth does move around the sun, it's going to move from one side to the other, and you're going to see a parallax effect. And that wasn't seen. We know that that's simply because things are very much further away than they could possibly have imagined. So there were these problems that were brought up with the heliocentric theory that took a long time to be sorted out.
Very interesting. And David Sobel, it's when you look at then some of the points that have been raised there and the influence of that German, the German mathematician and astronomer Georg Rectus, that seems to have been significant in bringing this publication then to the light, because it was that encouragement that, and as your work shows, that really had a big influence on Copernicus and this theory.
Yes, Rheticus arrived, and although he was a young man, Copernicus was an old man. They had different religions, different outlooks on many things. Nevertheless, he was able to convince him to go public with the idea. And Rheticus had connection to an important scientific printing press in Nuremberg. And that also was a powerful argument. And Rheticus hand-delivered the manuscript to the press in Nuremberg and oversaw at least the beginning part of the publication. Their friendship is one of the most remarkable parts of the story, because in the area of northern Poland where Copernicus lived, Lutherans had been banished, outlawed, which made Rheticus really an illegal alien. And somehow they managed to have him stay there for a period of approximately 2 years. And I have not found any clue as to how they managed that.
And was it a struggle to convince Copernicus to let the manuscript see the light of day? Did Rheticus have to, as you imagine, is there a lot of persuasion necessary?
Probably there was. They both talk about it. Copernicus says in the opening pages of his book how hesitant he was and how his friends pressured him and prevailed on him and finally convinced him.
And we seem to know that it's definitely before 1514 that he outlines the heliocentric theory, and probably around 1510. Would that be correct?
Are you asking me?
Yes. Oh, yes, Dave Isabel. Yes. Yeah, that is that correct? Around 1510, certainly before 1514.
Yes, and he wrote it up as Jim explained. He wrote it up as a brief sketch and sent it to some number of other people he knew would be interested. And at that time, there were, of course, no scientific journals. So correspondence was the way ideas were circulated. And it was perfectly allowable to make copies of a letter one received and send them on to other people for comment. And Copernicus participated in that activity. He commented on the motion of the sphere of the stars. As was mentioned earlier, he was invited to give an opinion on the length of the year for setting the date of Easter. So he, even though he was far away from the centers of intellectual activity, he was engaged, and people knew enough about what he had done to send Rheticus up there to write an account and get to work on Copernicus to make him release the manuscript he'd been writing for nearly 30 years.
Fascinating. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I'll be talking to Dr. Richard Tarnas about the importance of the Copernican Revolution to intellectual history and Western thought, Copernicus's philosophical vision, and how he transformed how we understand our world. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life, work and legacy of Copernicus. And it's a real honour now to be joined by Dr. Richard Tarnas, who's a distinguished cultural historian and the founding director of the graduate programme in Philosophy, Cosmology and Consciousness at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And he's also professor of psychology and philosophy there. And his books include The Passion of the Western Mind and Cosmos and Psyche, Intimations of a New Worldview. Richard, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can I begin by asking you about how important was the Copernican Revolution to intellectual history and Western thought?
You know, I don't think you can overstate the importance. It's such a tremendous transformation of the understanding of the human being and of the cosmos, of our role in the universe, of our place in it, and in very complex ways. It's in many ways the watershed of Western intellectual history, and in certain respects it can be seen as marking Copernicus's work can be seen as marking the shift out of the entire ancient and medieval worldview into the modern one. I mean, it is the moment of it's the pivot point, it's the transformation. And in certain respects, the entire history of Western science, philosophy, even important religious impulses are at work leading up to Copernicus. And then after his work, and it begins to have its impact in the larger, first the astronomical world and the scientific world, then the entire cultural zeitgeist. Everything in certain respects, right down to our postmodern age, can be seen as unfolding from that moment. So it's you really can't overstate how significant the Copernican Revolution is.
And it's always said that he transformed how we think about and understand the world. But I'm wondering about how he thought and understood the world.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because in certain respects, he was a traditionalist. He was the last of his tradition, both in the tradition of Western astronomy and science, and at the same time, he was forging the, without thinking of himself as a revolutionary, he was forging the possibility of a radically different view. In terms of his own perspective on things, I think, you know, he was well educated. You know, he was born in Poland and received his education both there and in Renaissance Italy, where he really took in much of the best of available humanist thought, taking in Neoplatonism and the Platonic tradition, taking in these astronomy and economics and so forth. But he was a devout Christian and a Catholic. He was a Catholic clergyman, and in fact, that's something to keep in mind, is that he did not, he himself was not condemned or anything like that by the Catholic authorities. In fact, they had asked him to reassess the science of astronomy from the point of view of creating a more accurate calendar that would, you know, take better account for where the planets and sun and moon cycles actually were, so that they could, so that the Catholic calendar of, you know, Easter and Christmas and so forth could all be more appropriately, accurately forecast. So he was actually sponsored by a cardinal. His theory was presented in the Vatican and was approved by the Pope. And so it wasn't a big controversy at the time he was doing it. That came later.
So given what you said there, do you think that Copernicus set out deliberately to transform the relationship? Because it sounds like this was more of an unintended consequence.
That's right, which often happens. I mean, Martin Luther set things in motion right around the same time that were also unintended consequences as far as he was concerned, just the movement towards secularism and the breaking up of the entire kind of unity of European Christendom. But with Copernicus, yeah, he was aware that his theory would, as he put it, be perhaps hissed off the stage immediately because it was so self-evidently absurd. I mean, we have to recall that it's quite obvious that the Earth is not moving. If the Earth were moving, then buildings would be falling over and we couldn't keep our balance. And also, you would expect that the stars would be, if we were revolving around the sun, then you'd expect that we'd be getting closer to the stars at one part of the year and then farther away. It took an enormous leap to make this this transformation of cosmic vision. In a sense, you have to imagine that Copernicus, his cosmological imagination allowed him to get off the Earth and see it from outside of our usual subjective point of view. And he recognized that while he himself was just making an astronomical innovation within a very small, you know, focused specialization in the academic world, at the same time, he thought that this is not going to go down well with the astronomical and mathematical authorities right away. And so he said, I feel like I should be like the Pythagoreans, who kept secret their most important breakthroughs. But he finally, with kind of encouragement from his peers and student, he did write it up, publish it finally in 1543, the year of his death, and it very gradually caught on, but it was very gradual. It wasn't until Kepler and Galileo, really, a generation later, picked it up and just, in some sense, actualized or realized, brought into full fruition the Copernican revolution, each in a different way.
And is it possible to assess his influence on other scientists, writers, philosophers, poets, thinkers across the centuries?
Absolutely. I could, if we had an hour, I could share with you one thinker, poet, philosopher after another, whether it's Friedrich Nietzsche or Goethe, who the great, in many ways, the greatest literary figure in the history of Germany, and a dedicated scientist himself. And in the last year of his life, he said, "I believe the Copernican Revolution is the greatest, noblest, most momentous discovery that the human mind has ever made. I think in certain ways it's even more important than the Bible," which, shocking as you can imagine such a statement might be, this would have been in the early 1800s, you can see there's even a kind of spiritual numinosity, a quality of almost sacredness to the Copernican Revolution that lasts to this day. I mean, the scientific tradition, a modern scientific tradition, really looks back to the Copernican Revolution as being the heroic starting point of its own brilliant history of revolutions and awakenings and the affirmation of human reason as being capable, like the sun itself, of shining light on everything around it, beyond our usual way of looking at things. So in both ways that would be seen as very positive, as like Copernicus influenced us all in being more confident about our capacity to understand the true nature of things, it gave tremendous confidence to the modern mind. And at the same time, it set in motion this sense of being decentered from the previous very special position in the universe, and that feeling of being, you know, decentered, more peripheral, and perhaps, and this was not at all anticipated by Copernicus or Kepler or Galileo, but as the centuries unfolded, the recognition that the universe is not divinely, the understanding that the universe is not focused on the Earth or on human history, and that we're not the center of universal meaning, which had tremendous consequences for the human being's sense of being of belonging in the universe, and also that kind of disenchantment that eventually unfolded from the Copernican Revolution, where what was previously seen as a profoundly meaningful universe in which the stars and planets were and the movements of the sun and moon and all these were seen as being kind of expressions of the divine matrix of human life and of the cosmos, very spiritual in character. Now this was seen as being of the same, having the same kind of mechanistic, naturalistic principles that were running it, as was happening here on the Earth itself. And so there was more of a sense of the disenchantment of the universe, which in turn created a sense of alienation for many thoughtful people, that they were in some sense living as strangers in a strange land with a sense of meaning and purpose that they felt as being important to them, but was not being held or responded to by the larger cosmos, which was just randomly evolving and it somehow produced our own conscious species.
Okay, well, Richard, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honor talking to you tonight. Dr. Richard Tarnas of the California Institute of Integral Studies, brilliant cultural historian. We'll be back with more on the life, work and legacy of Copernicus right after this break.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life, work and legacy of Copernicus. Before the break there, we heard from Dr. Richard Tarnas, and I'm rejoined by our panel, the wonderful Dava Sobel, Dr. Jim Bennett and David Moore. And Dava Sobel, can I ask you about the legacy of Copernicus? What do you see as his greatest legacy, and why do you think he and his work continues to inspire people today, and the very name has this special resonance?
I think the importance of the book resonates. The book itself survives. There are probably 300 copies of the first edition that are owned by wealthy private individuals and great libraries at universities. People find it fascinating that someone alone without benefit of a telescope, without computers, by the power of imagination and logic, could put together a system that answered so many questions. One thing we haven't talked about yet is the order of the planets, which was up for discussion in Copernicus's time. But when he put the sun at the center, that dictated the order, and then the speeds of the planets followed, so that they went from the fastest Mercury out to the slowest Saturn. So that was a compelling, unifying vision. And the book, interestingly, comes up for sale every now and then, not often, but when it does, it commands prices in the millions of pounds or dollars, wherever it's being sold. So the idea of this person fathering this alternate universe continues to grip people.
And there is something fascinating about the planets. My 3-year-old daughter Ellie is obsessed with them at the moment, and I think people of every age, there's just something about trying to comprehend the universe, our place in it, and he taps into that with these brilliant original thoughts and ideas.
And we do have a place in the universe. We're not at the center of it, but certainly we are of it. And I think many people find comfort in that. At the moment, as far as we know, we are the only inhabited body in the universe. Most likely there are many others, but we haven't found them yet. So people who need to feel special can hold on to that.
Jim Bennett, when you look at his legacy, and it's remarkable to think of the way it influenced so many thinkers, and indeed perhaps the whole beginnings of the scientific revolution.
Yeah, maybe we could take a different tack on that. I mean, he left an awful lot of problems. So I think one of his greatest legacies for the actual, you know, not thinking in terms of these grand statements, but thinking about what astronomers and mathematicians actually have to do, in, you know, when they get up in the morning, Copernicus left a lot of problems. We've talked about some of the difficulties that are in the system, like stellar parallax. I think it was David mentioned, but there's a very obvious problem. I mean, if we're moving around the sun and we're being carried around by one of these great spheres that are responsible for the circulation, this great system of nested spheres, where's our sphere? No one's bumped into it anywhere. You know, what's the thing that's carrying us around? Now, in book one of De Revolutionibus, Copernicus says it was a sphere. Well, no one's ever noticed that sphere, so that didn't make an awful lot of sense. And not making sense because people enjoyed the mathematics of the system, which is what Copernicus enjoyed as well. They wanted to solve these problems so that they could believe that the mathematics really reflected the reality of the way the system was. So that's where Kepler and a man called William Gilbert in England start working on on non-mechanical, non-physical means of carrying the planet, or the planet Earth and the other planets around in the system. And they thought of a sort of magnetic force projecting the not a mechanical force, but a magnetic force. And then, of course, Newton has universal gravitation and so on. So we go to a more immaterial kind of impulse, and that's a solution to a problem that's left by Copernicus. And there are a number of problems like that. The stellar parallax one was already mentioned. If you think of a really rational astronomer, let's say Tycho Brahe, who's an observational astronomer working in Denmark and then later in Prague, and he's very open-minded. You know, he believes there aren't any of these crystalline spheres. He believes that comets are in the heavens and so on. He believes all sorts of heretical things. He's not a Copernican because he's looked at the evidence, particularly the evidence of stellar parallax, and it's against Copernicus at that time. And on rational grounds, he thinks, no, I'll go for the difference. He invents a completely different system, but we needn't go into that. So it's easy to tell a story that has some sort of great kind of, you know, cloudburst of enlightenment, and it's not like that at all. There's a lot of hard work solving these problems that are left by Copernicus, but what's important is that Copernicus left a lovely mathematical system which the mathematicians could believe in and which got them better tables, and they wanted, the natural philosophers then wanted to be part of this and wanted to solve the many physical problems that Copernicus had left behind.
I think that's an absolutely beautiful and brilliant way of phrasing it and framing it. And David Moore, isn't that what great thinkers do? They don't just solve everything. They leave these problems behind that Jim has been talking about. And that was the basis of the later scientific revolution and later thinking to try and solve and resolve these remaining problems.
Absolutely. And Copernicus stamps in time, exactly, I think, when the human mind opens up to the idea of, you know, can we explain what's going on without any supernatural means, just by purely natural means? Is there a mathematical order behind the whole universe? Richard, there works in consciousness, which is an area that fascinates me, and I don't even know how to ask the question, what exactly is consciousness in a scientific way? How can matter that's in the universe be self-aware? And what does it mean to be self-aware? Does the universe even know about us? There are even bigger questions for the future. But Copernicus figuring out that, you know, this sort of, I said before, dogma as to how the way the universe was, because he wasn't the first that had suggested a heliocentric vision. There were Islamic astronomers who had suggested it as well, and others also. But I doubt very much he realized the can of worms that he opened when he moved the Earth from the center of the universe, put the sun there temporarily. We now know it's the Big Bang, really, and the universe doesn't really have a center. And he's left us with this fantastic legacy, the scientific process of, you know, having to prove that everything you believe in is actual fact and it isn't just a belief system anymore. And that's, I think, Copernicus' huge legacy. I was fascinated to hear Richard say the quote by Goethe that I hadn't heard before, that this is more important than the Bible.
Okay, well, I think this is a wonderful note on which to end our discussion on Copernicus. My thanks to my absolutely brilliant panel of experts tonight, four superb thinkers and writers and scholars. And it's been a great honour for me to have been able to ask them some questions about Copernicus and his thinking. David Sobel, author of A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionised the Cosmos, as well as some other major works. Dr. Jim Bennett, brilliant scholar, formerly of Oxford and Cambridge. David Moore of Astronomy Ireland, and we also heard from Dr. Richard Tarnas of the California Institute of Integral Studies. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we'll be reinterpreting Shakespeare's classic, Anthony and Cleopatra, exploring the history of Kylemore Abbey, and hearing about the hype man behind Muhammad Ali. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been Talking History. Good night.
Talking History on News Talk.